Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. The show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime by email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guests are Bridget Cromhouse and Tim Gross. Bridget is a principal cloud developer advocate at Microsoft and one of the hosts of Arrested DevOps. Tim is a technologist, operations engineer, product developer, and currently principal DevOps engineer at Density. What is the most compelling thing about DevOps, and you know, are we looking at DevOps as kind of the poster child for more collaborative efforts between kind of things like technology and operations? What's your kind of take on it? And, you know, is it exciting?
Sure, absolutely. Like, I think both of us have a lot to say in this realm. And I'll just start with, I think you're hitting the nail on the head. Like, this is more collaborative. It is about cross-team functionality. And it is about, instead of putting everyone in a little box and saying, hey, you only do this one thing and nothing else. It is about working across teams in a less siloed, if you will, way to get to our goals.
And I think that's probably the, you know, I think that's a really good take. I think I would add to it that, you know, with the overall objective of making, of delivering software faster and more safely and more humanely, right? So like in a, you know, make business value faster, as they say, but also doing so in such a way that isn't going to like burn out your teams.
That's super important.
I do think it's interesting though. You were talking about, you know, that it is about expanding the amount of stuff that a given person has and like less specialization, because I think that what's really interesting is that out of the tools that are coming out from the vendor space and are getting adopted by a lot of organizations, you actually see increasing specialization in a lot of ways. So there is, although there's kind of cross-functional work being done, I think that you're seeing, you know, you look at things like AWS Lambda, right, where it's like, you know, you're deploying a function, right? And the application developer who's associated with that can really just focus on that one thing and not the underlying platform. Which is an interesting thing, and it can work, but I think it only works in the context of, you know, there's an operations team, you know, people who are also specialists in the underlying platform who they're working closely with.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I mean, I work at a cloud provider, but I would say it would be massively irresponsible of us to say, hey, your individual dev who wrote a function can now run it massively scalable and meet all of your customer needs without ever talking to anyone else across the organization about things like data sovereignty or exactly how your fault tolerance works. Like, just because it's possible to YOLO something out into production without talking to some governance body doesn't mean that you don't need to be communicating across your organization as to how your software is going to scale and how it's going to meet your regulatory and customer needs.
Is anyone seeing any kind of organizational struggles because of that? Because of the way that I think technology is able to scale and maybe multi-purpose? And I don't know whether this is probably the right thing to say, but I think it's probably accurate in some ways that technology almost forces more of a flatline organizational structure. And certainly you see that from a lot of technical startups. Do you think that or from your experience, I suppose, are we seeing complexities there with the need for processes still, but technology is kind of forcing, you know, an element of hybrid and, you know, individual capability, and that's, you know, causing issues in traditional organizational structures?
Well, I think from my perspective, so Density is a startup, right? And so we're a much smaller organization. What I have found and that we're grappling with now as kind of a B2B organization where our customers are themselves large enterprises and have this kind of large regulatory structure that they have to deal with and, you know, have legitimate and serious concerns around security and data sovereignty and things like that. And then having to grapple with that kind of monster of a process from the perspective of a startup, in order for us to do that, we need these kind of like this DevOps mentality, you know, simply to meet that need, right? We need tools that will allow us to do, you know, automatic analysis of where our, you know, what's our patches in production, what's our, you know, things, tools like Chef's Inspect that allow us to turn those regulatory things into code. And without that, we really simply couldn't meet the needs of those kinds of customers. So I definitely see that there's a relationship between those two problems.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. Like, I've been at Microsoft for a couple months now. I spent the 2 years before that at Pivotal working with lots of large enterprise customers. And the ones that were trying to do things in what somebody at one point told them was a secure way that was very manual, with a lot of manual handoffs and, you know, human gating in the processes, they would end up behind, as opposed to the ones that built more automation that would allow them to deploy repeatably. So, like, that's where a lot of the cultural mindset of, you know, trust yet verify and have good tooling so you can have safe handoffs between teams and between organizations. That really helps speed up organizations' like journey, whether it's to the cloud or to a distributed IoT. What are we calling it now? Edge networking? I suppose you know more about that than I do, Tim. we have all sorts of, you know, 90s cyberpunk metaphors that we apparently are living in now. And I think that having better tooling, but also better cross-team collaboration using that tooling is the only way this is even possible.
So do you both have mentioned the DevOps culture. I'd be interested to learn a little bit more about what you kind of mean by that specifically, because I'm sure we can all relate to it in some sort of way, whether you're a DevOps engineer or not.
I gotta say that, like, I still kind of cringe a little bit when I hear the term DevOps engineer, even though I've had that as my job title a couple of times. you're there too, Tim. Yep. I think the problem with that is it almost is like saying an agile developer. And you're like, well, I mean, I hope all your developers are, you know, doing MVP and like iterating, but it's funny just because I think it's very common, and especially since, you know, you folks are in the recruiting space, like, it's very common to see on a job description. And what you mean is somebody with, you know, solid automation chops. But it does, the concept of DevOps is a little bit broader than that, because it talks about, like you mentioned, it talks about the culture inside your organization being open to hearing across teams what kind of places you need as an organization to iterate. Not necessarily just in your code.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. So I think that there's probably an element of misconception there with DevOps then, clearly, for non-DevOpsy people, even though, of course, we're all agreeing that that's a cringe term now.
I think it's one of those things that the different definitions that people are using is a good example of how, I mean, I think Bridget bringing up Agile is actually an interesting example, because it's a good example of how a particular term gets used, you know, gets started around one idea, which is about this cultural, you know, this idea of cultural transformation. And, you know, you end up with DevOps consultancies pop up and, you know, and people want to sell you the DevOps, as part of kind of a, in a box. Yeah. DevOps in a box. And it becomes this kind of like, you know, there's this other like, you know, mix, partially because of the just weird incentives that our industry has around this kind of stuff. So you end up with all these different people trying to co-opt the term for whatever it is that they particularly need. So I try not to fight too much about the definition, but I would definitely agree with, you know, at heart, it's what, you know, is what Bridget was talking about. I think, for example, so I'm going to bring it back to an example, you know, within my own organization, I got brought on at Density a couple months ago now, and kind of the way the conversation had gone was that they wanted somebody to do automation work, but what they really realized kind of after, an extended conversation with them, is what they really needed was a way to get their web and mobile application developers, their embedded systems developers, and their machine learning developers to all kind of start speaking each other's language, and needed that this kind of like cross-functional flow of information and culture and tooling to start happening. And that's kind of what a lot of my role there was has been.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so from a cultural perspective, you know, how does that progression start? Like, who's pushing that? What what stakeholders are pushing that that cultural to kind of flatline culture that you're speaking of? You know, whose responsibility is that to ensure that it, you know, there is a consistency there, from your opinion?
I think that's going to depend a lot on the organization. I think what I've seen at previous roles where I was working closely with large enterprise, we found that there were often, you know, infrastructure teams who were kind of getting kicked from, you know, they had, so there was a particular customer of ours when I was at Joyent, who had, you know, an application development team and a system administration team who was running hardware, and both of them were kicking this guy like 100 times a day and calling him a blocker. And so, you know, in that organization, it was really, this kind of team that was stuck in the middle that needed to start bringing these kinds of ideas in so that they could break down that barrier and stop being, you know, and stop this kind of fight going on within an organization. So that was kind of a very bottom up sort of thing. And I think there are other organizations, and I think Bridget could probably speak to this more, that have kind of a more strategic view of it, rather than a this is a desperate thing we need to do view of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, there's actually, and I think that you definitely should get Nicole Forsgren and Jez Humble, you know, the folks working on the DevOps survey to come in and talk about this, because there's a lot of solid peer-reviewed data at this point that shows that organizations that have better collaboration and communication across their organization, we can call it DevOps, they are deving some ops, but organizations that are better at that are, surprise, surprise, a lot more effective in shipping code faster and in shipping code with fewer errors and in recovering from errors faster. And it seems almost too obvious and ridiculously intuitive when you break it down, like, hey, humans who feel safe in experimenting and feel safe in their work to not be arbitrarily condemned for trying something new are going to try things. And if the thing that they try doesn't succeed immediately, they'll just, assuming they have both a positive and supportive culture, but also, of course, decent tools and automation such that they can iterate quickly. If they can iterate quickly and learn from whatever experience they have with the new code or new processes that they try, then like I would say throughout the organizations that I've worked with and throughout the industry, we've seen leaps and bounds of higher performance in terms of, you know, consistency and accuracy and, just shipping code faster from organizations that make an effort to work in this way.
So it kind of brings me back to an interesting point as well, and almost a level of poignancy, I suppose, certainly on Bridget's end with the rest of DevOps podcast and the whole idea of the kind of sharing economy that we seem to be in. My concept of that from a broad perspective is that for whatever reason, the culture, the technical culture, you look at things like GitHub, it is like open source, sharing. People will want to put as much information out there as possible so that others can take advantage of that. That's the kind of culture that from, you know, a pretty much a non-technical person like myself, looking at the technical community, that's where that kind of movement has come from. Is that remaining consistent, you know, in this need to kind of, you know, share and share our findings? And does that need to be put into place in the workplace? And is that the case in the workplace? Or do you kind of butt heads because for whatever reason? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel to draw, and I would love to hear Tim's take on this, because I think that the rise of open source and the cultural practices of DevOps aren't necessarily, you know, one dependent upon the other, but they've definitely grown together in a way that, you know, is mutually beneficial and helpful. I would say, like, currently at Microsoft, and it's funny that I work at Microsoft now, because if you, like me, started working in tech in the 90s and you were a Unix person, Microsoft would not seem like an obvious choice. But, you know, I joined Microsoft, they issued me a Mac, and they said, go get people to use Linux on Azure. And I was like, 2017 is weird. Okay. and if a company like Microsoft can invest this much in open source because they see it as beneficial to their cloud business. I mean, this is not a large company is not doing this just for charity. Like, sure, okay, Bill Gates is over in Africa doing amazing charity work. That's great. But a large company that is publicly traded is not going to do everything just out of the goodness of their hearts. And they do it because working in the open, working in an open, you know, open sourcing your software gets you better visibility into any flaws that could be in the code base, because the community can report stuff. And anyone who, you know, feels motivated for their workplace or personal career goal reasons can improve the software. Like, this is basically, it's just a win for everyone. So, like, that, you know, open source being, you know, open source having won is, I think, possibly slightly orthogonal to, but also really beneficial to people who are also trying to, in their organizations, instead of building closed proprietary systems that nobody can cross collaborate because they can't even have any visibility into, or they can't even work with. Like, instead, I know that like at his last job at Joyent, Tim was doing a bunch of open source work with people who, you know, I've ended up talking to over in my role at Microsoft. It's like, oh, you're working on those same open source projects with him. So what do you think, Tim?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not just open source, right? It's also like open technique, right? It's about, there's a lot of sharing about, like, well, these are like ways of working that we've done that are working for us, not just the code. So I think that, although open source is like kind of the ultimate example of it in some sense, you know, knowing that, I was at a talk by Fastly a couple months ago where they were talking about how they do incident command, and it was really interesting because that was a very useful topic for me when I started, you know, developing our incident response process at Density, even though it was a very different organization. And I think one of the interesting things that's happened with the way that we hire is that we've in some ways have aligned incentives for the people within our organizations to share, because that's how they're going to get their next job. In an organization that doesn't necessarily share outside the organization, someone who is sharing within the organization, that will also be good for them, right? So, like, if you're in a large organization and you are putting yourself out there, a process or a tool that you've built, and you're sharing that with other people within your organization, that's going to be good for you. That's going to be good for your career within that organization. Obviously, if you're able to put out open source software, and putting yourself out in the community in other ways, like say giving talks, that's good for your career as an individual, and it's good for the organization. So there's like a really nice alignment of incentives sometimes there. There's also sometimes a weird misalignment of incentives, because I think that if the organization doesn't know how to treat that, how to deal with that problem, then you end up with this, you can kind of get this cycle of like resume driven development where, the people within your organization are going to go do that anyway, whether you like it or not. And they'll bring in all kinds of weird stuff into your organization's technology stack, to make their resumes look good if they don't have other opportunities within your organization to be innovative.
But it's going to be a mainly positive thing. I mean, surely, just as we've all experienced through our careers, you internally, you get caught in a bubble. Proactively look in and start to look externally. And now, you know, it seems to be even easier than ever to do that. Just the sharing of information has to be kind of productive for the community and, you know, from a macroeconomic standpoint as well.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. But like, there's, as Tim was alluding to, there's a lot of things organizations can do to align incentives. And if it's not possible for individuals inside the organization to grow in their career, in their visibility publicly, in whatever way they're trying to grow, if it's not possible for them to grow inside the constraints of what helps the organization, they will find other ways. And then you'll be left with something in production that the person who put it in production left. No one else really wants to support it, but it's now this integral, fundamental part of your stack that, you know, is written in Erlang that everyone's kind of terrified of.
I think, and that's like, that's where I think the, an organization that has healthy attitudes towards innovation and is going to get all the advantage and is going to have very little of the disadvantages. And, you know, and making that work does require leadership within the organization, I think. You know, you often need, you know, folks who are senior within the organization who are going to kind of like guide that awesome innovative energy within your team into ways that are going to be aligned with the rest of the organization. But like that's the job of your CTO, right?
That's true. Well, I suppose there's still an element of responsibility when you look at the recruitment, the onboarding, there's the responsibility of all team members, I would assume as well, to kind of integrate accordingly. And I'm also curious about this topic myself. You know, I'm not sure how much extensive experience you guys have had with, you know, building and managing, you know, DevOps teams. But the criteria now seems to have shifted slightly to where people need to understand. And I do say, I think that we are expecting more of technical people now because of this. But I do think that people need to have a bit more of a macro awareness and understand where their team fits into the business outcomes and the key business drivers now. You know, are we seeing a lot of different personalities joining teams now and DevOps teams because of this, and you know, different I suppose backgrounds and characters? And I suppose, is that, I mean, surely it's a positive thing, but you know, are we seeing this kind of shift because of, you need to have this awareness, not just the technical capabilities?
I mean, I think that, you know, interviewing and hiring is hard. It's hard to even get candidates, as you well know, because of the way our industry currently is going. But I think that one thing that I really appreciated when I used to work for Tim a few startups ago at this point. And one of the things that I appreciated in his interview process was it was very conversational. Like, he didn't come in quizzing me so much, or there was no code on a whiteboard. But I do remember, you remember this, Tim? We sat in that little office and you were drawing on the whiteboard. And then at one point I looked at your drawing and I said, what about this? And I think I opened up like a can of worms, and you know, I found something in the infrastructure. Like, I think it was the next rev of the infrastructure that you were going to do, that I was like, but what about this terrible flaw in your plan? And you were like, what? And we Googled, and then you were like, oh. Yeah. Like, it was very conversational.
Yeah. And I think that kind of, I have tried to bias towards communication. And I think that, one of the tools that I've done is kind of a very brief technical exercise that somebody can do on their own. But it's actually very, like, from a technical standpoint, it's fairly easy. But what this test is really about is, you know, how does this person actually communicate their process of discovering what the problem was and, you know, and their approach to solving it? Because that skill set is much harder to teach someone than the technical skills, right? I think that you can take someone who has, you know, modest technical skills and skill them up. It's a lot harder to teach them communication and empathy.
Do you think that that's inherent of technical people in general, that they struggle to articulate? I'm sure that's generalizing, but, you know, by nature, is that the case?
I think that's a bit of a lot of the folks who have come into the industry within a certain time period have had that problem, because that was kind of like where the culture was allowing. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think that's a, it's not a very helpful stereotype, frankly. I think that it's one that if we by accepting that stereotype, it kind of reinforces it instead of saying, no, you know what? It's actually not okay for you to be kind of like this, you know, robotic, like, I don't, you know, all I care about is the technical side of things. Like, that's, to me, I mean, and maybe there are organizations where that works. I kind of suspect that there isn't.
I mean, they're it's not going to work if the organization has humans in it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe if you have an organization run and populated entirely by robots, that could work. But I think we, as an industry, overvalue the technical, what appear to be straight up technical communication, or sorry, technical contributions. Mm-hmm. But in reality, none of us are operating in a vacuum. I mean, even people who are developing something by themselves and just, you know, putting it out on the internet are still probably going to have interactions with people in an issue tracker or whatever, you know, somebody sending pull requests to their project, whatever. And then, like, as soon as you scale your organization up to having 2 to N people in it, you're going to have a matrix of communication that it is essential to have the communication inside your distributed system of humans be as fault tolerant and as robust as the communication that you build inside your distributed system of computers. Like, I've given many ranty talks about this just because I feel pretty strongly about it. Like, if the sci-fi reading nerd kid, aka me, who got a CS degree in the 90s because she didn't want to talk to people, can manage to talk to people, like, all right, I think the rest of you can too.
Yeah, well, I think it's lack of transparency is never healthy. But it's always interesting to pose that question. The only reason why I ever would ask that question is just because, you know, from our experiences talking to clients, talking to candidates, you know, there seems to be a lot of new personalities coming into the tech industry. But I think that my actual take on it is it's just that because of this generation has had more access to it, and hence that's why we've had more different types of personality come into it. But I suppose that's just my take.
I mean, I think and you'll have to tell me what you think, Tim, but I think that the conversations in our industry around making sure we're valuing contributions that aren't necessarily labeled technical, but are in fact essential to having your teams say, like, your project testing or your flow of which features get developed in what order, like, the stuff actually matters. And you might not call it technical, but it's going to have huge effects on, you know, the technical capabilities and quality in your organization. What have you seen around, for example, like, prioritization?
I think that that's, I don't know, I have trouble seeing that as anything that's new. I mean, I think that, like, if you were to be successful, right, I think that this is not a new thing. I think that folks who try to say, I'm only going to worry about the technical thing, often, by the way, are not actually being very truthful for themselves, right? I mean, we look at things that are, like, you know, kind of borderline technical contributions, like, you know, is a code review a technical contribution, or is it actually a deeply cross-functional kind of contribution, right? It's actually about, you know, it's about the technical evaluation something, but it's also about the evaluation, you know, the empathy that you show to the person who's writing it, you know, the opportunities to mentor them if that's kind of the relationship that you have. You know, the analysis of how that piece of code lands within the greater business context, like, that's always been a part of the way that our organizations are supposed to be operating. And I think that, so I have trouble seeing that as something that's new. I
think we might be being more explicit about the fact that, at least in some organizations, we're more explicit these days about the fact that, sure, say, mentoring or code review are important parts of the role.
Yeah.
You don't get to just come in and write code in a vacuum.
Yeah. Now, if we're talking about, you know, I think we're kind of dancing around that, the demographics of our industry may be changing. And yeah, I mean, I think they are. And I think as Bridget said, like, the explicit acknowledgement that it isn't just about, like, who can crank out the most code, I think has a huge factor in that, right? It says, oh, you know what, this stuff that, we all knew that was, or we all should have known is important, actually is important in acknowledging it. And, you know, I think that has a different, it makes it possible for people to stay in the industry, or potentially stay in the industry, who, you know, often would be chased out, if it was all about, you know, this like kind of robotic, you know, code. I don't know. That wasn't very well articulated, but
I think you're hitting on something important, which is when our, and everyone, I got to say, I speak at a lot of tech conferences, and often people say, you know, we're hiring, or raise your hand if you're hiring, and 98% of the hands in the room go up. So, like, this is making sure that we don't lose people out of our leaky pipeline, and making sure that people are able to contribute as much as they want to contribute throughout the industry is, I think, relevant to everyone's, everyone's organizational needs at this moment, for sure. And so I think it's really important that you point out that if we, as an industry and inside our specific organizations, explicitly value things like giving code review in a non-adversarial way. I mean, you're not going to say, you're super, and let's just talk about this code that's totally broken. Like, you don't have to do that. But there's a counterexample that you can see anytime you go over and look at the Linux Curling mailing list that, like, we don't want to be like.
Interesting, guys. Really interesting. I'm sure you've probably covered it quite a bit, haven't you, Bridget, over on your podcast?
We talk somewhat about culture. I think that, and because DevOps, I feel like we need a jazz hands in there. DevOps, jazz hands. It's such a broad topic that sometimes, sure, we'll over on Arrested DevOps, we'll talk about the technical deep dive on something specific, or we'll often talk about the changes necessary in your organization so that you can even hire and you can attract and retain people who will work in an effective manner. I mean, again, this is like, if people have choices, we can all posit at this point that people have choices as to where they want to work. And so if they have choices, they're probably going to pick some place where they're not going to be miserable all the time. I'm stating very obvious things here. So, like, if an organization is trying to attract people who will be able to bring their automation to the next level, then spoiler alert, you probably need to not all be jerks. Like, it's difficult to imagine that sometimes, as humans, like, we don't necessarily treat each other the best, but I also don't think that anyone is intrinsically a jerk and will stay that way forever. I mean, I think even Linus Torvalds could probably choose to not be a jerk. Like, it's just a question of, like, how you choose to present yourself to the world and how you choose to relate to people.
So to that point, actually, I'd be curious about, both of your experiences and kind of what projects you've typically gravitated towards, because I can imagine there's been certain points in your career where you had this kind of innate vision for what you were going to work towards, what you were going to build, the type of company that you wanted to work for. I just wonder if there has been a consistency in what you have gravitated towards, or whether that's kind of changed over the years.
Tim has a really interesting perspective on this, so I'll just give you the short and sweet. It's all about the people for me. I've worked at organizations of 15 people, and I think Microsoft is 120,000 and everywhere in between. And I think that you don't work with all 120,000 people every day. Like, so the people that you're going to interact with the most frequently make the biggest difference for me. How about you, Tim?
Yeah. I think that's a huge part of it. For me, I also have, and I just went through kind of a joint where I was at, and I was kind of going through that, what kind of place do I want to end up at? And, I had good conversations with a number of different organizations that all kind of were at different points within kind of the scale and scope and where they were in their lifespan. And so for me, a lot of it comes down to, like, what does the organization value as well? Which is a people question in a lot of ways. Some of it is also about, like, what are they building? Not just what is the product that they're building, but what are their ideas around the kind of organization they want to build? And also like what kind of impact I can have. I have naturally gravitated to smaller organizations throughout my entire career. I don't think I've ever worked at a company with more than 200 people in it. That's just the way I like it. And it's great that they're, I know Bridget loves, has had good experiences with larger companies, and that's great. I think there's lots of room in our industry for people who like all those different things. So for me, a lot of it comes down to one of the things that I've really loved about Density is that, the team, has a lot of, very intentional, does a lot of very intentional work around culture. Like when they, not in the, well, we have ping pong tables and foosball, right? Like that was actually like one of the things, when I went to the interview and I was like, there's no ping pong table here. Awesome. Right. they're there to work. But they want to do it in a way that's humane. They want to do it in a way that doesn't, burn people out. They want to do it in a way that people feel fulfilled. They want to do it in a way that, the product itself doesn't make the world worse, which I think is, a really nice idea.
Should, by the way, we have two guests on this podcast. I work for Microsoft. They probably require no introduction at this point. Though I will mention that I work in the part of Microsoft that focuses on Linux and containers on Azure, which is maybe not a part of Microsoft people even know exists. But I feel like you've mentioned Density a couple of times and nobody probably knows what they are. Do you want to give us the elevator pitch?
Sure. So Density makes a depth processing sensor with an embedded machine learning algorithm that anonymously counts people moving out in and out of a space. Our customers consume our API to make decisions about how to best use their real estate. But the really important point, and this kind of goes to that point of not making the world worse, is that it's anonymous people counting, right? So this is the ability to analyze the way that your space is being used is very important to people who have a lot of real estate. But doing so in a way that doesn't violate the privacy of the people who are doing that, who are moving in and out of that space and using that space. So we're not like doing MAC address tracking or, facial recognition or any of these other things, these horrible, horrible ways that, companies are violating people's privacy. It's actually just a depth sensor that can detect whether the thing that's moving through the space is a human or not using reflected, infrared light. So that was kind of a really important thing for me when I said, this is really interesting work that you're doing, interesting from a technical standpoint. But is this something that is going to actually make the world a worse place? And I really wanted to make sure I wasn't going to land at a place that was like that. So that's certainly a factor.
The impact bit was interesting. I think that Tim mentioned earlier. I feel the same way. I've always worked for small companies also. Sorry, Bridget, 100,000.
Yeah. Yeah,
that even in a big organization, there's ways that they can, I think, encourage, incentivize, and make it obvious that the impact you're having is significant in a certain way. So I do think that it's possible, but I think it's obviously a lot more difficult. Aside from that, I suppose we all want to have these kind of certain check boxes off in our careers. Is that the right way to approach it? Have we stopped checking boxes? Have you guys stopped checking boxes at this point? And,
Checking box, I think that honestly, the one box I check is, do I think I'm going to be happy every day working with these people doing this work? Because a lot feeds into that rather. So, mm-hmm. If it were, as all of us do, I get recruiting messages all the time, and I've gotten recruiting messages from, contractors in the military and arms space. It's I don't think you're making the world better. I don't want to work for you. Or some of the players in the social space where I'm like, I don't think you're making the world better. I don't want to work for you. So I think that, as Tim was alluding to before, this idea of mission, you don't have to be a charity, but I don't want you making the world worse because I don't want to help you make the world worse. I think that's pretty important.
Yeah. And that's also an understanding of, the abilities that you have, and the I suppose the power that comes along with having the ability to you know, to code and do technical things now is so scalable that the impact is significant. And I just wonder whether you think that some people probably underestimate like just how impactful their work is in the technical community now.
Yeah, and I think that that's on. I think that feeds, unfortunately, into you know, I think that people fail to recognize that power actually gives them a lot of say. You know, that they don't have to like, well, you know, who's going to give me an offer first, and like, you know, or who's going to, and also like for people with, you know, that these particular skill sets, you know, generally speaking, the money is pretty good. So, you know, really like quibbling over, you know, a very small, you know, delta either way for between a couple of different organizations usually isn't going to make or break you, you know? So that often tells me that, you know, if people are saying, well, I'm only going to chase the one that's giving me the biggest offer, I think they're maybe missing out a little bit on an opportunity to have a bigger say in kind of like the overall happiness of themselves and their impact in the world.
Yeah, I think that's, you make a really good point too, that for those of us who lucked into, and let's just be realistic, like it is lucky that we ended up being interested in something that ended up being super lucrative instead of just a weird nerd fringe thing.
Yes.
But those of us who lucked into that, I think we have a responsibility to, you know, when we're having conversations with a large organization, ask them about their trans healthcare. Do we plan on using it? Not necessarily. Ask them about their parental leave. Do we plan on using it? Not necessarily. But if we can, while we're, you know, walking this world full of privilege, if we can give those little bit of ripples that are going to help other people, I think we have a responsibility to. Like, I think it's incumbent upon us.
It's a good point. It's a really good point and a powerful thought as well. And I think if more people had that perspective on things, you know, maybe it comes from an education standpoint. I think that, you know, if you're a junior person, you might not perceive things in that way and probably fully understand you know from a high level what you could potentially work it, help in an organization do. So maybe there is an education there that needs to be had at an earlier point in people's careers where they, you know, they actually do fully understand, like, you know, things from a high level, from a macro level, what they're kind of helping work towards. And yeah, maybe people would perceive things differently and you know, have the outlook that I almost said you guys, then sorry about that. Tim and Bridget have, so.
Yeah, it's interesting too when you think about, and I am definitely no expert on mentoring junior anyone. It sounds exhausting, but they all have so much energy and they don't want to go to bed at 10 p.m. No, but the idea of, I think I at least try to be a good example. I'm very ambivalent about, you know, award anything just because it seems kind of ridiculous, but I am going in December out to the Google campus in Mountain View actually to do a like top 10 women in cloud award, which I find when anybody makes a really, broad sweeping statement like that, I just want to argue with it. Like, there are definitely not only 10 women doing something interesting in cloud, and of the ones who did something interesting in cloud in 2017, I don't think I'm one of the most notable 10. But you know what? What I can do is I can use the fact that I'm going to be standing on that stage for a couple of minutes to point out all the places that we can try to reach out past ourselves and be more inclusive of other people. So if we have junior members of our teams, bringing it back to the hiring thing, if we have junior members of our teams who could do a great job on something but aren't perfect at it yet, why do we not have a senior person, you know, pairing with them or doing code review? Like, that's something I think a lot of our organizations don't necessarily prioritize because they think, well, I don't want to take two people working on this when it could be one. And it's like, well, it's not an either or. It's not a Boolean. It's not like you're pairing 100% of the time or you're never going to help each other ever, you know? And I think a lot of our organizations don't look at that with enough nuance. I mean, I think that there's places where when Tim and I worked together, like we were remote from each other, but we would sometimes do a lot of code review or from time to time collaborate in person. And I remember a few outages where it was just like we were on a Google Hangout or on Slack or whatever, working on working on the problem together, and you get more than just the sum of two minds. Like, you get the ideas that you spark between each other.
And I think that kind of like, and, you know, we kind of went down this track of, you know, the broader culture, you know, outside an organization. But I think that point really brings it back to what we were talking about kind of towards the beginning, which is that this is actually a really good, like, this isn't just, I mean, yes, this is about empathy. And yes, this is about inclusion. And yes, this is about making a better role. But it, like, it also has that really awesome side effect, which is that it's really good for the organizations, right? It's like, this is win-win-win all around, right? Because it's like, you know, your organization is better at delivering what it needs to deliver when that's the case. So it's not, this isn't just like some, you know, hippie drum circle stuff. This has real value for the organizations that can adopt it.
Well, the organization we worked at together. Yeah. Well, I mean, the hippie drum circle is awesome, and the organization we worked at together got acquired by Warner Brothers. So that's kind of a win for everyone.
Amazing. So, just some kind of closing thoughts for me. I mean, it's been really interesting, and I just would be curious to see, you know, moving forward, what would you like to see? And we'll say as DevOps, but, you know, and I know you're both really vocal about kind of the whole DevOps community, but what do you hope that the work that you're doing, the podcast, you know, getting the word out there about the culture around DevOps, what do you hope that the impact is? And is there kind of a vision moving forward for, you know, across all technical disciplines in approaching things in a certain way? Is there a vision that, you know, would, I suppose, give you a great sense of satisfaction for the work that you've conducted so far? I know it's a big question, but...
I mean, okay, I'll go first because I know Tim does a really good, you know, insight on this too. But I'll just say I was on call for production for 15 years. That can make you bitter, and it can make you really exhausted. And I think that we can treat our humans, who are parts of our complex systems, better than we have historically. And so if I can help people build and you know, maintain systems that are more humane to interact with, then there's a lot of happier people than there otherwise would be. So that's pretty important to me.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, for me, I don't have, you know, a grand vision. For me, I always kind of, I'm more comfortable working in the small. And so for me, it's about, can my organization be better? Can we be happier? Can we be more empathetic to each other? Can we deliver better? And sharing that with other organizations is like, you know, I hope that other people can take that on themselves, and feel empowered to do that themselves. I think that, and I do get a lot out of it when I hear, you know, like, hey, this tool that you built, or hey, that talk that you gave, or, you know, hey, that blog post you wrote, or whatever it is. You know, it was helpful to me. It was helpful to me personally or to my organization. Like, that means a lot to me. When I get that kind of, that feedback, that it was helpful. So, you know, I think that's enough for me. I have small ambitions.
But I think those are really important.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think it's, I don't think you've probably given yourself enough credit there, Tim, but it's been fascinating. And thank you so much for taking the time. We'll leave it there for now. I'm sure you have a lot better things to do with the day than teach me for another hour. So thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.